created the bleakest economic landscape since the Depression of the 30s. NPR's Bill Buesenberg and Deborah Amos traveled to Costa Rica to produce a special edition of Communique on this country's changing economics and politics. We'll hear it at about 3 o'clock. The recent surfacing of some of the radicals who had gone underground in the 70s has provoked many people to think back on the radical movements of the late 60s and early 70s, and to compare the ideology and values of radicals then with the politics and lifestyles they now have. The Black Panthers were one of the most militant groups of the period. With me to talk about the Panthers and to reflect on the issues and strategies of the time compared to the 80s is Bobby Seal, who co-founded the Panthers with Bobby Hutton and Huey Newton. He also became the chairman of the party. He was one of the defendants in the Chicago conspiracy trial, along with Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and Rennie Davis. You'll recall that Judge Julius Hoffman had Seal bound and shackled in the courtroom and gave him 4 years contempt of court. When he refused to be silent until given the right to defend himself, his lawyer of choice, Charles Gary, was in the hospital at the time. Seal is now based in Washington, D.C., where he's organized a group called Advocate Scene, which he hopes will eventually develop into a lobby for minority programs. One component of the organization is a self-help group, which he hopes will boost self-esteem to increase job opportunities and family relations. Bobby Seal joined us close to a year ago on Fresh Air, and we asked him back to compare his politics now with the politics of the time of the Panthers. And in a little while, we're going to open up the telephones for any questions or comments that you have. Bobby Seal, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk with you about some of the history of your life and of the Panthers that we didn't get to when you joined us about a year ago. Mm-hmm. Do you stand by now most of the actions of the Panthers?
Do I stand by? How do you mean?
Do you...
You mean the philosophy and what we were talking about doing in those days?
Yeah.
In terms of our 10-point platform and program that that Huey P. Newton and I both wrote out and outlined together, yes, because that 10-point platform and program is about, one, full employment, decent housing, and preventative medical health care, and end to police brutality and murder of black people, the right of black people and other peoples to right to control the destiny of their own communities, justice in the court systems, et cetera. The latter part of that 10-point platform and program summed up was about land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace, which reflected upon the need of black and other peoples to alleviate themselves from the oppressive conditions that they were under in an exploitative, capitalistic, and racist social order. When you ask me, do I stand by, I think what comes to my feeling most is the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, which was put into that original 10-point platform and program that Huey P. Newton and I outlined and put together. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for a people to separate themselves from the political bonds, meaning the political bondage, which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind dictate that they should declare the causes which impel them to that separation. Those were great words, and I used to do a lot of things. I used to imitate John F. Kennedy and attempt to imitate Martin Luther King and Malcolm X saying those words in their idiomatic great oratory ability, and that was great to me. The second part of that paragraph, as a particular sentence in the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, and it states that when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursues invariably and evinces a design to reduce the people under absolute despotism, then is the right of the people to alter or change that government. Now, this is in the Declaration of Independence of the United States of America, 1776, okay? This is the summarized feeling, of where I was coming from then. And probably before that, it's just that when we founded the Black Panther Party, I focused in on it much more. And, I stand by that. I'm a political revolutionary by principle and philosophy. The word revolution to me is not what everybody thinks it has been termed to mean in terms of other countries. Whatever the revolutionary process that went down in Angola is another thing. And whatever the process that went down in Cuba, or whatever the process that went down in Russia in 1917, you know, decades ago, it's quite different. And I do not think in terms, quote unquote, of coups on the United States government. You know what I mean? That's not it. I think that. And then, of course, people say, well, Bobby Seale, you were a socialist then. I was what you call quasi dabbling in concepts of socialism. And I knew that then, even then, Huey and I understood that things were quite different here in America. And to this very day, more so today than before, you know, I actually run around the country in a lot of college lectures. I declare that I do not believe that state-controlled socialism concepts will even work in a highly developed technological social order such as America. While it may have been necessary, you know, in the underdeveloped countries, you know, historically and most recently, what I'm saying is that the particulars in those underdeveloped countries is quite different from the particulars here in America, because this fast-paced scientific technological social order is also intertwined with trampled upon democratic rights, you know, or democratic rights to politically organize, etc. And, of course, this is what happened to the Black Panther Party in its attempt historically from mid-60s on to try and use our democratic rights to politically organize the people to opt for political power, that is, to come from the community with organizational principles, beliefs, and philosophies, and ultimately try to give the people in the community some real true control over what? I mean, we used to talk about Black Power then. Well, Hugh and I got sick of people just with the rhetoric of Black Power. That's part of the reason why the Black Panther Party evolved. And it was about, okay, we asked ourselves a question, Hugh and I, and we must have went around for about 3 months with different friends, different organizational people in the Black Student Unions, the Afro-American Association, and people who were in the Soul Students Advisory Council, one of the Black student groups that Hugh and I started at American College when we were going there. And we began to ask, what is a good definition of power? In terms of, because we were then were thinking about organizing the Black Panther Party, we yet hadn't come up with a name, you see. And so we came up with that. We remember Huey really, in effect, because Huey is really a theoretical kind of a genius when he really picks it all out and lays it out. He says, then therefore, after we went through all these discussions, therefore, power is the ability to define phenomena and in turn make it act in a desired manner. So what was the phenomena that Black people and other oppressed people were subjected to, you know? The overt racist police order, the political power structure and its exploitation, and, of course, the atmosphere then with Martin Luther King, the NRA, the Nation of Islam and the Black Muslims at that time who were being viciously attacked by the political power structure, the phenomena, the overt phenomena of police brutality in the midst of this atmosphere of the demand for civil rights, etc. So we moved to organize the Black Panther Party on those kinds of principles, you know. We were about trying to deal with political electoral organizing because we believe that the real power beyond the rhetoric, you know, was really people's power, one. And then two, what do we mean by that? It meant that we had to look at the political structure of things. And we began to understand that it was not the executive offices of the presidency or the executive offices of the governors, you know, or even the mayors who may have veto power. You know, different cities have different kind of governmental structures. But it was the legislative bodies themselves who dealt with our tax monies, who robbed us, who gave the loopholes to the corporate money rich to perpetuate their exploitation of us, etc. So we needed to control the legislative bodies. And from the very inception of the Black Panther Party, Hugh and I knew then that ultimately we would run for political offices and or support candidates as a means to, you know, for people to try to take control of those legislative bodies. I mean, Oakland, California, for our initiating example, had 43% blacks in it, you know, and 13 or 14% Chicano people, and that was Hawaiian and Filipino people, et cetera. So that's where we were really coming from. Except we went out on the issue of point number 7 to deal with the police brutality issue, really because at the time, Huey P. Newton and I were employed by the city government of Oakland in the Department of Human Resources. Our checks came from the city government, you see what I mean? And we were working in a North Oakland neighborhood poverty center, and we lived in North Oakland. We were, you know, that's just where our community was. And we had been working with the advisory board of middle-aged people, you know, 35 to 65, who represented the poverty program monies in terms of that targeted North Oakland area, you know, 300 square blocks in that community where we live. So, and they was concerned about police brutality. We was concerned about it, and we was concerned about it from a point of view that police brutality caused riots. And riots was an unorganized situation. The people not organized for political power. You know, 50 people get killed in a riot, 200 get wounded, and 5,000 arrested. But because we couldn't get a police review board, see, we got on the agenda of the city council to be heard via the advisory board, and they refused to listen to us. And that's really the grounds by which the Black Panther Party emerged and began to exist, because we start patrolling police, and our notoriety became something else other than what we were really about.
Sure, well, you started patrolling police with guns.
With guns, with tape recorders, with law books. And you see, what people don't understand is that Huey had finished, what, a year and a half in law school. He had already graduated from Merritt College. Then he did a year and a half in law school following that, you see. I was 3.5 years in college, you know. I had dropped my engineering major, you know, and jumped over into the social sciences and the political social majors. And here we were, you know, young guys had been putting scrutiny to that whole struggle since the 1960, you know, and 61, early January 61 or so. And here we were now in 1966, October, in a warm poverty office in North Oakland, and we decided to create another organization, just he and I starting off, and then little Bobby Hutton was. It took a little while, but by the time I went on the state capitol in May 2nd, 1967, 24 males and 6 women, armed to the gill as we were, but the weapons were not concealed, of course, because we understood the law. To protest the continuing police brutality, and also we put another little issue there about concentration camps or something. But this is the way the party started. And we needed the attention. We needed to capture the imagination of the people so they could really understand what our objectives was about. You see what I mean?
Was that what the guns were for?
Well, the guns were for that, but it was also about defending ourselves, because it's a principled stand, you know, that we took. You know, I mean, we looked at it in the same manner that people in 1776 must have looked at it when King George III was dominating them in the 13 colonies, you know. So here we are, like a black colony in the context of a community, you know, who were being oppressed from the racist forces outside. In particular, the most significant enemy was the political power structure using the police agencies and the police forces to repress any attempt on the part of the people in the communities to voice their opinion, redress their grievance by the First Amendment of the Constitution, et cetera. And this is truly what the party grew out of. Now, we had a lot of rhetoric, a lot of hardline talk, et cetera. You know, we need to walk on this power structure and say, stick them up, bastards. We come for what's ours, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We had all of that, but we were getting shot at. You know, we was going to jail. We was getting brutalized, too, you know, and some of our people was getting killed. So our rhetoric became rough, and we were young and pragmatic in a lot of senses.
Do you think that having the guns made you shot at ultimately more frequently than you would have been if you didn't have arms?
Well, that's like asking the question. Bobby Seale, see, if you hadn't have picked up the guns, then you wouldn't have gotten shot. That's like trying to blame my oppressed condition on me. You know what I mean? We were already getting shot at. Our black community was getting shot at. What we need is a focal point of organization. What had happened, though, you see, it was in, let's see, October 1966, the Black Panther Party was created. Several months, 8 months prior to that, in Los Angeles, California, following the Watts riot in 1965, it was a community alert patrol group of black people who went out in the community with armbands on, and all they had was tape recorders and law books. And their attempt was, if we stand around and watch the police when they make an arrest with our law books, and if something goes wrong, they'll quote from the law books, therefore the police will not brutalize anybody. And by not brutalizing anybody, we won't have a riot in the community, because it was really a riot that started, I mean, an act of brutality that started the Watts riot. So there we were, remembering that. What happened to that group is that group got its law books towed up, its tape recorder smashed up, their heads banged up, drugged downtown, and locked up, okay? So we says these people were exercising a basic democratic right. And by the California state law at that time, and Huey in law school and everything, we researched a precedent that every citizen had a right to observe a police officer carrying out his duty as long as they stood a reasonable distance away, and a reasonable distance had been constituted by California Supreme Court ruling as 8 to 10 feet. So all we did was added the shotgun, you see, and the pistol, along with the law book, et cetera, and some uniforms, and a 10-point platform and program outlined 2-3 pages of what our Black Panther Party was about, and some applications if you wanted to join it, and let people know where our address was and when our meetings was happening on every Wednesday night at 7 and Saturday at 2 p.m. with our guns. This is the way the Black Panther Party got going, you see. So, yeah, they didn't like it. But in effect, what really happened is that there was no shootout till a year later. In fact, that first year, no police drew a gun to shoot at us. They were shocked. They knew we was in the law. We would not let them take our gun from us. You know, let me see that gun. You can't see this gun. Am I under arrest? No, but I got a right to see the gun. No, you do not have a right to remove a person's private property from them without due process of law. Huey P. Newton articulating this, you know. This was great. It blew their minds, and we'd spread out, you know, and you got 50, 60, 70 black folks looking. I mean, they're getting behind things, you know, in case there's going to be a shootout. But this is blowing the people's mind. Word of mouth gets through the community. Hey, them brothers are standing up to them police, brother. But what we're telling the brothers and sisters, read this 10-point platform and program. Start reading this booklet, you know, Autobiography of Malcolm X, et cetera, and so on and stuff, and learn to understand where we're coming from. This is, we was trying to get to the people, capture their imagination, et cetera. What happened was, it was a year later. We started the party in October 1966, and October 1967 did Officer Fry attempt to murder Huey P. Newton. Huey was shot through the side. The bullet went straight through in his left side, you see. And in effect, he was down in the hardcore black community, you know, and people knew us. They loved us and liked us. And one cop winds up getting killed because other people start shooting, you see. And then another cop who was there, you know, he got wounded, shot 8 times. And that sort of helped further jettison the party beyond my just taking that march on the Capitol with the armed group, you know. But we really never got in a shootout or a battle for over a year. You see what I'm getting at? And besides the patrolling of the police and talking to people, we were in issues like going to the city council with the advisory board committee, or a signal light at a corner. There were 3 kids and got killed and 3 then got wounded there, and it was a dangerous corner, and it was a heavy traffic area, especially during commuting hours. And then we had a school a block from there, and our black kids, and they're telling us down at the city council it will take a year and a half before we'll able to, because our city engineers have not set up to get a signal light there, and we're saying in a year and a half we could have anywhere from 5 to 20 people killed in the black community, let alone the other people who get in accidents there and are injured. And they didn't like it. So we and Huey took our guns and got us some police whistles and went out there at the corner of 55th and Market Street and proceeded to direct the traffic, because they wouldn't even send a police cop down, you know. And when the commuting hours came, the white middle class drive through our black community on 55th Street going up to their nice middle class homes, and we'd back the traffic up, you know, and that in effect caused those people to protest downtown about us. They got to get it, and we were fooling around, and we got the signal light there in 6 months instead of a year and a half. So you see, these are the kind of things that we were involved in other than just patrolling police, and this is the kind of tactic methodology that got the North Oakland black community and the Oakland community in the San Francisco Bay really relating to where we were coming from.
The visual image of the Panthers was the beret, sometimes the bandolero, bullet holders, leather jacket. It was nearly a uniform, or maybe
yes,
officially
it was
a uniform.
It was a deliberate uniform. A lot of people thought our black leather jacket, when people just heard about it, they thought we were not in motorcycle leather jackets. We were in sport leather jackets, slacks, black slacks, and the black shoes shined. And it was about respecting your black community first and understanding where they're coming from. Sure, we had dashikis and we had our naturals, but we didn't wear those, you see. What we knew is that we had to attract the American black community who have a ebony slick mentality. You see what I mean? This is what they're looking for. And we were sharp. We were clean. And this helped to attract them. It's like, hey, this is our new police force in our community, which was not a police force, but we were a political party. But it attracted people, you see what I mean, to say, hey, it represented organization. It represented something, you know. And the type of office we initially got, I mean, some of our offices later on were terrible, but our initial office, it was very slick and modern. I mean, you know, modern doors and stuff. And we got tired of going to the black community with these little dinky offices that didn't really represent any organizational effort, et cetera. These are the kind of things that me and Huey thought was necessary, that we criticized a lot of other organizational efforts about, et cetera. And coming from the grassroots down in the black community, this caused a lot of people to give a lot of respect to where we were coming from.
What image did you want to communicate to white people and to the white middle class, many of which interpreted the uniform and the guns as militancy that might at any moment be directed against them.
Well, the politicians, and I would say hypothetically off the top of my head, 50% of the media deliberately did this. They over-sensationalized us. People like Mayor Daley later says the only reason the Black Panthers have guns is to come into the white community and shoot up the white folks, which was not true. Our first encounters with a few white folks was that you got guns to do what? To shoot us because you hate white people, you know. And what it was, they thought we were coming from an over-stereotyped position of where the Black Muslims was then. We were not coming from that. What we was telling white folks was is that you should be working in your community to break down the racism in your community, to stop that racism from maintaining the political racist oppression that's coming from the political power structure via its police agencies and forces that you control. And we want some control, and we got a right to share in that power. Actually, what happened readily, you know, with where we were coming from, because we were not what you call a hope-to-die Black nationalist organization, although it was a Black organization emanating and catalyzed from the Black community. We wound up, within a year or so, 12 months or so, we had a coalition with the Peace and Freedom Party, which is a predominantly white left organization. Later with the SDS, we created the National Committees to Combat Fascism, so a lot of white groups and organizational people could work in conjunction with us, but to try and have a framework by which we coalesce a lot of organizational efforts, because we believed in coalition politics, you know. We wanted that image because we understood the value of, from a humanistic standpoint, of people uniting in opposition to the wrongs and not uniting or dividing on the basis of race, per se, you see.
I'm talking to Bobby Seale, if you're just joining us. I spent part of last night reading your autobiography, A Lonely Rage.
Yeah.
And you describe a lot of your life in it, but there's one moment after Malcolm X is assassinated where you're so angry and are so unsure of how to express that anger that's set up after the assassination, that you're standing on a highway or a main street, I forget which.
No, I'm in a city, type of city street. I'm across the street from Merritt College because that's where my mother lived, where I stayed. It's just a four-lane inner city street. It was a period. You know, I had already been in the struggle, since 61 or six early. And it was hard for me because I had... See, at first it was Martin Luther King to me, and then sort of I shifted over to where Malcolm X was coming from, and especially when he got out of the Nation of Islam, more so, because at that point I was contemplating to go out to New York and join his organizational framework, you know. I forget the Organization of Afro-American Unity. But when he was killed, it was on me, you know. I knew I'd committed myself then, and then I would be committed. And just out of the clear blue sky, and I didn't really know it. It wasn't a planned thing. I was throwing bricks at white folks driving down the street in big limousines. That was the closest thing I could get to the power structure symbolically, you know. And I had a one-man riot going down the street, you know, and what have you. And I said that you bastards have killed Malcolm X. And I was very hurt, crying and everything. And I says, damn it, I'll make a Malcolm X out of myself.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is you probably came across a lot of people who had incredible rage brewing within them who didn't know how to channel that in any way that could be constructive in getting the kind of changes
that
they might desire. So I guess what I'm asking you is how the Panthers try to channel raw anger and rage into a movement that could be constructive.
That's in effect what was happening.
Once you tap into rage, what do you do with it?
You got to channel the energy. It's a lot of political education to give people a perspective about how to use that energy and what to use that energy on. I mean, people have to shift the rage from just standing on the corner, jiving and talking and saying, man, these white folks ain't this and these white folks ain't that. And then suddenly something happens and the rage comes out in a massive riot. And we understand why, because the people are oppressed. But it was a thing that it wasn't a planned pat thing. It just happened that I knew the need, you know, then that all these young brothers, if a young brother or young sister had the audacity from a lumping proletariat type position to rob or steal, can I get that energy over here to say, do you have the audacity, you know, on a principle, very noble level, and rightfully so from a democratic principle, to stand up patrol these police out here who may shoot you and kill you. They'll shoot you and kill you for robbing and stealing, right? So do you have the principle to do this and put you in jail? You see what I mean? So it's doing that to get people to think twice. You know, I mean, if you got guts enough to die out there for nothing, then here is something that you can take a chance with life and death for something that makes some sense.
Talking with Bobby Seale, and in a few minutes we'll be opening up the phones for your questions and comments. The image of you bound and shackled in the courtroom during the Chicago conspiracy trial is an image I'm sure all of our listeners remember. Did you want to get your part of the trial separated from the others who were indicted
in
the trial?
No, that's one thing. That surprised me when Judge Julius Hoffman severed me from the trial after, what, 6, 7 weeks? That very really surprised me because I knew I had him then. And it wasn't a planned thing, you know. When I disrupted the courtroom, that was in 1969, what they say, the newspaper says, Bobby Seale disrupts the courtroom. Now, that word was just totally really out of context. Every time my name was mentioned, actually, I sit at the defense table quiet. I had nothing to say. But I knew that since my lawyer was not in the courtroom, the judge denied me the right to have that, also denying me the right to defend myself after I had made a written motion that I gave the court clerk, and he had heard me on it the very first time, 1 or 2 days after the trial started, and then denied it. And I knew by the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, I had the right to legal counsel of choice, not his choice, because he was trying to push Bill Kunstler off on me. And, you know, I've been defended by the Black Panther Party. We were paying our Charles Garris and them firm, you know what I mean?
He was in the hospital, I think.
He was in the hospital in a gallbladder operation. It was necessary. The man was 60-some-odd years old. He had to have the gallbladder operation before he go through a new trial because he could die. His doctor had written letters. The judge had that months before I was even brought into. But Judge Julius Hoffman denied it. So here I am. Every time my name was mentioned, I would stand up. I say, I object on the grounds that I have not had a right. I do not have the right to defend myself. I object on the grounds that my lawyer is not here. And Judge Julius Hoffman, set that man down. Shut that man. And the marshals charge me. You know what I mean? I says, no, I still object. And for the court record, and I knew I had to get in on the court record. You know, the person that sits in the court and checks out every word that's being said. And I'd understood at least enough about legality that if I sit back and was quiet, and would not say nothing after Judge Julius Hoffman said that, well, Mr. Kunstler can represent you. And if I had sit around and said nothing, in the end of the trial, what would have happened was, it says, well, Bobby Seale did not object. There's nothing on the court record about this. And therefore, he must have, in effect, this is where the higher courts would have ruled, he must have accepted. So that was your lawyer and forget it. And I was being railroaded. So no, every time my name was mentioned, I got and said, so we would get in a colloquy. We would get in an argument to the point of the fact that sometimes Judge Julius Hoffman was so shocked. And sometimes he wouldn't even say, shut up and set that man down. I'd stand there and start talking. I'd start him calling him a racist. I'd say, I'm hip to Superman comic book politics you're talking about. I think Nixon is this and boom, boom, boom. And, you know, I'm coming. And I had a forum. So I had the man in a corner in a strict sense of the law, Sixth Amendment, Constitution, right, legal counsel of choice. And ultimately he says I was being contumacious. Well, actually, I was not hip to the word contumacious. I didn't realize that it meant contempt. I said, well, I don't know what you're talking about, et cetera, so and so and so and so. And do you know you could be chained and gagged? Well, you know, they asked us, what are you going to do? Kill me? Put me in jail? I'm already in jail. And it didn't make any difference to me. And ultimately, this man chained, shackled, and gagged me to a chair for 3 days in the courtroom. Then at one time, they almost passed out, you know, almost died. They put these big bandages on me, these basketball player knee stretch bandages that tighten up when you move all around my neck and under, all over. And it was just a thing, and finally he cut me loose. And so I sit there for a day, and he put up a man on the stand, and the man started testifying against me while the other lawyers for the other defendants was talking. He mentioned my name, and so I sit there and I waited. And so when he says, does any more of you lawyers want to cross-examine this man? And Consul says no. Lenny Weingast says no. I says, yes, I would like to cross that. No, you cannot. I walk straight up to the lectern. I says, now, sir, and I start cross-examining the witness. Just tells him he doesn't have to answer. I kept asking, why was you following me around in the airport in the first darn place? Do you always do this? And this kind of thing. Boom, 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 boom. Next thing I know, I'm severed from the trial. Now, this, the last thing, happened after the 3 days of gagging.
Everybody who, not everybody, but a lot of the people who were at the forefront of radical politics in the 60s and early 70s have written books telling about the politics and ideology and actions of their time from their point of view. And just as different people perceived it differently as it was happening, different people are writing about it differently. If I could, I just want to read you what Abby Hoffman wrote about the trial and see,
okay,
see how you're
recounting
jazz with this. Here we go. This is from the Hoffman book, soon to be a major motion picture that was published about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Panther Party, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was competitive ego rivalries, wanted Bobby separated from the trial. It was more complicated than simply personality clashes, though, and a lot had to do with black-white relationships in the American struggle, in other words, movement politics. But no one was motivated by these not-so-noble impulses alone. A black man chained and gagged because the court refused him the lawyer of his choice, then refused to let him defend himself, needs no interpreter. Nothing in our trial, or in all the political trials of our time, could match the power and truth of that moment. What always struck me as particularly interesting was that the prosecutor, and I suppose the government behind him, consistently attacked Kunstler as the manipulator of events and accused us of, quote, using Seal as a puppet, unquote. In fact, the controls were entirely opposite. The Panthers controlled the defendants instructed the lawyers. See, in the government's head, whites control blacks, professionals control clients. But inside the movement, and in reality, the exact opposite was true. And again, that's this quoting Abby Hoffman.
That's basically true. That's basically true, because what we refuse to do out of SNCC's experience, SNCC had an old experience where a lot of young whites had came in, and young whites began to run everything. And what we did with the Black Panther Party is that, and that was that internal black community politics of white people have no right in those days to run a black organization, you see what I mean? And it was leveled against the NAACP, the Urban League Corps, et cetera, back in those days. When we evolved the Black Panther Party, it wasn't that we were going to cut white folks off like most of the nationalist groups finally decided to do. What we was going to do is we was going to relate to them. Now, here we are in the black community. If you truly are not prejudiced or don't want to act in a prejudiced or racist manner, then you can help us do this in terms of our community. We run our own organization, STOP, our own central committee composed of black folks from the black community, but not just black folks from the black, people who were really there, the women too, because, you know, our central committee really turned out to be three-quarters women. Most people don't even know this, you know what I mean? They think it was all black males, et cetera. It was not true. I'm talking about this decision-making body, national headquarters of the United Black Panther Party in the United States of America. Anyway, that was what was happening. We told them where we were coming from. We were not going to go for the jive, et cetera. The Black Panther Party with me on trial, et cetera, we in effect laid it on the line. We were not backing up 1 pound, you know. And we have to take a harder stand probably than most of the young white radicals have to do in the movement, et cetera. And we were not playing. You know, we were getting killed out here. We're getting murdered. We're getting shot at. Our officers are getting attacked. People are going to jail. We had 2,000 people arrested and are charged in jail around the time that I was even in the courtroom. So, yeah, he's basically right.
If you have any questions or comments, we're going to open up the phones. Our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. The number is 923-2774, and my guest is Bobby Seal. He says that the Panthers wanted you to have a separate trial. So,
yeah, they wanted to, but that was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
The party wanted that, you know. They would have liked to have seen a separate trial. They thought it was a strategy kind of situation since Charles Gary wasn't there, et cetera, but it didn't happen like that, you know.
What kind of differences and what kind of solidarity was there, as far as you were concerned, between the Panthers and white radicals, many of whom came from more middle-class backgrounds, like some of the people in the Chicago conspiracy trial, a lot of the people in SDS. Was there a conflict between the different economic backgrounds
That was a broad social conflict that wasn't too surfaced, you know what I mean? It wasn't a surface argumentative type thing. Black Panther Party itself probably had a greater contradiction with our hardline cultural nationalists who did not relate to concepts of evolving new economic practices in the country in terms of something other than the capitalistic racist social order, and capitalistic order of economics. We had a working coalition with SDS. We had a running working political supported effort for political offices as we attempted to do in 1968. So I ran for political office twice in my life. I ran for state legislature in 1968. We had we structured the National Committees to Combat Fascism. So whether you was white, black, blue, red, green, yellow, or polka dot, you could join the National Committees. On a slow surface level, we thought that maybe 10 or 12 years from then, probably the Black Panther Party would emerge away and the National Committees to Combat Fascism would emerge on a broader scale in terms of a mass people's movement crossing racial lines, but first going through the coalition politics of opting for political control of legislative bodies as a stepping stone towards liberation futuristically, you see, but it did not happen per se.
I guess part of what I'm asking is that some of the white radicals of the time felt really uncomfortable about their middle-class background.
What happened is, and I think Jerry Rubin brought it out pretty good at one point, and that was that when 35,000 people came out on the green for me in 1970 in New Haven, Connecticut, when I was still in another court trial, stated that we don't have to be guilty about our white middle-class backgrounds. What we have to do is be dedicated and committed to changing this corrupt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think he was trying to get people above that, you know, because the moral aspect of the overall movement that emanated in terms of young white radicals from middle-class families that were supporting the civil rights movement initially before the Black Panther Party really came along, people defined it as young whites functioned off a concept of guilt. But I think it was more than that. I think it was young people who had the feeling and human feeling that, you know, racism is just wrong. It's just not right. You know what I mean? The killing and the murder, et cetera.
So you don't think there was much guilt tripping going on within the movement?
I don't think it's so much guilt. It's not especially when they started getting brutalized by police and their sit-ins, free speech, demonstrations, et cetera. They were getting crash courses in police brutality we've been knowing about all our lives. You know what I mean? And they begin to realize, you know, that, hey, you know, I think we later on when the Weatherman and SDS split, we had a differences of tactics with the Weatherman, that's the Black Panther Party. And it wasn't based on whether it was white per se. It was based on the tactics that we didn't think was necessary. I think we thought that it was a little bit ahead of the masses of people in the country. And I think they felt that they was on time with respect to the mass movement of young white radicals. We're talking about 20-odd million plus that were supporting that movement on one level or other around this country, all the way from the psychedelic rock level of down with the establishment phraseology and meaning, all the way to the organized efforts of SDS and many other left-wing white radical type groups. You know what I mean? I think that we understood that was a line of racism that was still keeping us apart, but we at the Black Panther Party understood the necessity for coalitions. Right? And we didn't feel that even the black community, you know, was going to follow, per se, young white radicals. We really didn't feel it, you know. But I think they accepted the fact that the Black Panther Party, you know, could be in coalition with them since they had got on a forefront level of confrontation from the courtroom to the streets and demonstrations.
Bobby Seale is my guest. We're inviting you to call with any questions or comments. Our number is 923-2774. Let's take the first phone call.
Okay.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
Fine.
Hello, Bobby.
Hello, how you doing?
Okay. It seems too bad that our government was able to decimate the ranks of the Black Panthers so easily, but find it so difficult to eradicate the KKK and the American neo-Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I'm much more severe menace to our society. And I want Bobby to answer two questions for me. Will we as black people continue to experience polarization of our classes? And does today's economics, are they designed to keep any revolutionary spirit to remain dormant and from ever reemerging?
I don't think so. Let me go back to the first part of your question. True, the racist power structure did everything they could to attempt to smash the Black Panther Party. But the real reason why the ranks of the Black Panther Party dropped in this country, I mean, and don't forget, I'm still going back to J. Edgar Hoover law enforcement agencies and the political racist power structure and all their attempt, and they violated our civil and our human rights and our democratic rights across the board down to right outright murder. They did do this. But the ranks of the Black Panther Party dropped because of a central committee meeting decision at the time, a year and a half before I actually ran for mayor of Oakland. The Central Committee of the Black Panther Party, 19 members of us, and I was the only one arguing against it up to a point that I finally agreed. We had 28 chapters and branches scattered around the country in late 1971. We had a number of meetings for over a month and a half about the need to run me and or Erica Huggins and or Elaine Brown for city council and myself for mayor of Oakland, because remember, that was our goal objective, was to control the begin to set an example of controlling legislative bodies. What happened here is that when we decided to break down all the chapters and branches and concentrate all the members as we could from all the chapters and branches throughout the country into Oakland, California, for the purpose of running this campaign and winning it. Remember, we lost. We came right close to winning, right at the edge of winning, but we lost. And at that point, we had approximately, I would say, 1,300 or 1,400 members of the Black Panther Party concentrated. That means all our resources and everything came from all these cities. And, of course, when we did that, when we actually started the country, we really had 3,000 members, but that was half of them who didn't want to leave their cities and thought the Central Committee was wrong. But we thought that we was right. And after we did not win the campaign in 1973, April 1973, we came close to winning. Following that, that 1,300 members we had left dwindled in a matter of a few months down to 200 members. This is really, really, truly what happened. And it was hard to even try to begin to think in terms of putting that back together again. And so a year later, I even resigned from the Black Panther Party because I remember other things in life when I look. Dialectically, Hugh and I used to say that nothing will ever stay exactly the same. That's a dialectical observation a lot of people need to make. At the same time, I knew from a personal standpoint and a personal commitment standpoint, it is a wise person who knows when to move on to other things. So I resigned in July of 1974. That's one. Two, the money-rich power structure in those days when black folks start opting to organize people for power, J. Edgar Hoover and others, the law enforcement agencies, the political power structure, made the Black Panther Party the bullseye of the total movement. If you had a big bullseye in the outer circle, if you had the NAACP, and in between that you had the anti-war movement, and in between that you had the NRA, the New Republic of Africa, etc., in the bullseye would be the Black Panther Party. So that's where they put us, and they did do everything they could to try to survive. But we weathered them. We weathered them all the way into 1970 when Huey came out of jail. I mean, really, the 1960s movement era was like about a lot of spontaneous mass conscious raising, numerous events and numerous different type of black leaders and radical leaders, what captured the imagination of people in this country and made a lot of millions and millions of people think about what was going on from the war to racism and exploitation. But what I'm saying is in 1971, 72, the corporate money-rich power structure, the political power structure, and the law enforcement agency probably decided that stop attacking this movement, because if we continue attacking them, by 1980s, they will have the masses of people on their side. But then, of course, stop the Panthers, because we were really truly about them. But see, the Ku Klux Klan is about a fascist ideology in the first place. And the corporate money-rich power structure with its political cronies and flunkies, you know, in our political frameworks, can use this in opposition to any people's movement, whether it's Jewish people, whether it's unionization, whether it's what. You see what I mean? So they allow them to have the guns.
Okay, thank you for your phone call. Okay, bye-bye. My guest is Bobby Seale, if you're just joining us, and we invite you to call with any questions at 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, Terry. Bobby, I have two questions for you, very short. One is, in his book Ring Alivio, Emmett Grogan says that part of the reason why the Diggers, and for those people who don't know the Diggers, they were the San Francisco collective that did free food, free entertainment.
I remember them.
So forth and so on. Were so successful is that nobody really knew who they were. They had a name, but no one knew who the leaders were. No one knew who, you know. And they did a practice. They had an absolute practice of anonymity. Anybody gave them away was instantly out. The first question then is: do you think if the Panthers were not so high profile as personalities, and you and Huey and Fred Hampton and so forth, Do you think that possibly they could have accomplished their objectives a little better? In other words, it was less cult of personality and more, hey, who are these guys? We really don't know.
No, I doubt on that question. I doubt that very much because, you see, we were dealing with a black community that was largely apathetic, that largely still to this day, and that's bad, needs some kind of leadership titular head thing. I think it would have been bad. I think that we captured the minds and attitudes of more people by being out front. What we tried to do was have a multiple form of leadership as opposed to just one. Because it was not only Huey Newton, it's Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, Eldridge Cleaver. We tried to push David Hilliard out there. We did push Fred Hampton out there. We was trying to push Elaine out there, Erica Huggins, etc. And I think it was necessary. We had a Democratic Centralism Committee. I think it was necessary. If we'd ever been pushed underground, which we never were, we would probably went into guerrilla warfare on an urban style level, not down to, and not we're not talking about South America or something, but I'm saying probably, you know, because we always thought about the possibility that may happen. But no, I think at that time, the Black Panther Party probably, by being up high profile, et cetera, did serve its purpose because we changed the mode and put a new character to that very movement, you know, the Black Liberation Struggle. You had a second question?
Yeah, the question was, I mentioned Emmett Grogan before, and I was wondering if in your travels you had ever had any meetings with him at all.
I have not, and if I have, maybe it's because he got a low profile and just sit and watch me from the side. But, I mean, I talk a lot. I lecture to 30 or 40 colleges a year, you know, especially in the spring. And I meet a lot of former Black Panther Party members, a lot of my old former radical buddies, guys who have never really been known publicly that I run into, you know, old young Lord leaders, what have you, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, there'd be little chance to meet Emin as he's dead.
But, what was that, please?
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for your calling. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to ask one question. What does he think of the possibilities, given all the problems that we're facing as a race of people in this country, of the possibilities of there becoming some type of black independent nation here?
Yeah, a black, quote-unquote, independent.
Well, I don't mean independent as such, but, you know, someone who has self-determination.
I think that the closest that black people in our relationship to other people on the face of the earth are going to probably deal with black independence is going to be our direct connection with Africa. I think that's very important in the way we connect ourselves in terms of future world politics, in terms of future economic growth, and in terms of future black people having a greater control of the destiny of their lives. I think in the context of America, what I do is first understand what the particulars are here that we're subjected to and, of course, how they relate to the future. I talk a lot about community-based economics, community control of economic frameworks that retail and produce services and goods. It is an economic concept. It's a philosophical concept that needs to be molded into a practical ideological goal objective. It really hasn't been done so yet. The problem with the 60s in connection with this very question you asked me is that we made a big mistake, a lot of us, and I have to say for the Black Panther Party and the other organization. See, the Black Panther Party, the NRA, the New Republic of Africa, remember those? The Nation of Islam, the NAACP, the CORE, SNCC, SCLC. We never sit down at a table to hammer out a practical ideological goal objective as it related from where all of us were coming from in that 60s movement era. That's the greatest mistake we made.
Let me
finish, sir. And what I'm saying is because we never did that, it never gave us a perspective about what we're supposed to be doing here in America as a people. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand that the Irish people have economic frameworks. The Italian people have economic frameworks. Jewish people have economic frameworks. And largely the Anglo-Saxon groups of people, and they intermingle and intertwine. To what extent do we intermingle and intertwine with other Chicano and Hispanic people in terms of an economic practice that makes some sense, relevant not only to us, but also relevant to other poor white people, and that economic system being in direct opposition to the exploitation and racism that perpetuates and represses us? I do not think it's necessarily going to evolve, but I think when we think in terms of black independent nationhood, we have to connect that with Africa, and we have to begin to think of Africa and more in terms of where we're going economically in the world in relation to the mineral resources and the ground of Africa, et cetera, you know, and all the different countries in Africa.
Thanks very much for your phone call. We're going to have to get going.
What do you think of CIA sophisticated brainwashing techniques that they are applying.
Okay, thanks for your call, sir. And if you can answer that really briefly, because we're running
I'm really not into the fine particulars of it. I'm hip to the method. I'm hip to the fact that they're doing it, and what I think of it, I think it's a continuing wave and methodology of their fascism.
Okay, we'll have time for one brief phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air, and please keep it brief.
All right. I've enjoyed the interview. My question is dealing with the feminist movement as defined by a coalition of groups lobbying for the ERA amendment, women's right to choose abortion, etc. I'd like to know if you're in sympathy with the feminist movement and how, in your opinion, the feminist movement could gain more power today.
I'm in direct sympathy with the feminist movement in this country. I'm in so much direct sympathy in it that I relate a lot in these days and times to a group called Hooray for Black Women out of Cleveland, Ohio. And I was hoping that that group of organizational framework, and they have 5,000 women every 1 or 2 years participate in that effort. And what I'm really I'm concerned with people understanding the need to evolve a new economic practice. I'm concerned with women taking a much greater profile in the future liberation efforts of black people, Hispanic people, or any kind of people. But I'm concerned with black women being there, you know, much more so than they were in the 60s. They were there. Now, don't get me wrong. They were so profoundly intertwined into it. It was a crying shame. But my greatest problem is trying to get black males and a lot of black females to see that their values are outdated, and let's kind of get a lot of black males to see that what one of the greatest problems they have is a continued identification with white racist male chauvinistic mores and views in terms of their relationship with black females. I think some of the worst things we have going in this country right now is the strained relations between black male and black female. In other words, our community is divided from that point, from the family starting. You know, we got 60% of the black families in this country is run by a black female. The black male is gone. That is a division in our black community. And the problem is that most black women do not see the necessity of using 50% of their energy and time to accentuate themselves, because they have a great problem from old teachings to put 100% energy into their relationships with their black male. And the black male, who's adopted bad values from the white chauvinist male, he either has his penis in front of his ego or his ego in front of his penis, and one ain't no better than the other. In other words, they've got to change their values. We live in a highly fast-paced technological social law. This scientific computer data science social law is outrunning the black community. And I want to see the ERA and cooperate in understanding of this more so than it has done in the past. I would love for ERA people to bring me to speak, to talk, to rap, so they can get an inside view, because I am criticizing and also trying to contribute an understanding to new values as it's related to this. But all the other moves that the ERA has been made and the feminist movement, yes, I support it highly. It's the very essence to the fiber of change and establishing new human relationships, because the old human relationships is just outdated for the type of fast-paced society we have.
I'm very glad to hear that. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. Well, Bobby Seale, we're close to being out of time for our discussion. But what were you thinking about when the people were captured in the Brinks robbery? Because it became a time for people to think about different forms.
First of all, the brothers and sisters and the people in this framework and group, I'm sure they're very, very sincere. They're dedicated people. You see, I come from that whole framework. You know, some of them are former Black Panther Party members, et cetera. It's just that I believe since the 1960s was about a lot of pragmatic, you know, but at the same time, relevant and necessary, capturing the imagination of the people. That era has already happened, you see what I mean? It has really, truly already happened. Now, when it gets down to it, what is the 1980s and into the 90s going to have to be about? It's going to have to be about community-based, programmatic, political, economic, issue-oriented, computerized and computer-bank organizing. That is to raise the consciousness of the people. We have to incorporate this tool more so than the guns that we used to have in the 1960s. I mean, Huey Newton and I captured the imagination with the Black Panther Party and other Black Party members, too. Remember, it's a lot more than just Huey and I. It's a lot of women and a lot of black males who put a lot of dedication in, who, boom, that was there. And I'm saying that the techniques and the tactics, we do not have people organized for objective purposes in the community. So when they are at the threshold of some potential victory, then they can react in a more profound way when the corporate money-rich power structure attacks us in that more profound, overt way as they did in the 60s, if it happens. And I think that, and I mean, I really don't know their philosophy. I have no right to criticize them. I'm not in the middle of them, but I think that on the general sense, if organizational groups is going to think that this is the methodology, we're bad, we're tough, we're militant, we need this status, you're not going to get it. They're going to sidestep you. The media is going to downgrade you. The politicians and everybody else is going to misuse it. They're going to help polarize this country on a racist level more so than before. You're going to miss the point, I really believe. And I think that we have to get down to that real nitty-gritty community organizing for the goal, objective, purpose of evolving a new economic practice, starting with the process of seeing can we organize political, electoral, community power, especially in the black communities where there's high concentration of black folks. And I'm not saying that that's going to work and that's the last statement. I don't like people misquoting me and taking me out of context. So that's just a stepping stone process. And after 21 years in this struggle, and I'm still in it, you know, on one level or another, I do a lot of community organizing training seminars around the country for organizational groups and organizational representatives, legislative seminars with Congressional Education Associates out of Washington, D.C., and a lot of other things. And this is my way of contributing now because I see the need for high levels of coalitions of organizations, et cetera. But at the same time, I understand where they're coming from. I mean, I understand profoundly. In fact, I sympathize with them. In fact, when I hear, if it's true, and I don't know, I mean, it may just be a fascist tactic against the BLA, the Brinks holdup, and stuff, because when you start looking at it, these guys is federal FBI making all these arresting the wrong people and whatever who wasn't even there, et cetera, you know, and I understand what they probably be going through. But if this is so, if it's really so, the tactics are somewhat outdated. I think they have to incorporate. I think they're probably would be better off incorporating the tool of the computerized systems with their organizing efforts, more so at this particular time. I mean, not forever, but at this particular time, than with guns, you know.
Okay, I want to thank you for sharing your views with us and for also telling us your perspective on some of the history of the radical movements of the 60s and 70s. Bobby Seale, it's been nice to talk with you again. Thanks for being here.
Sure.
Bobby Seale was one of the co-founders of the Panther Party and the chairman of the party. He's based in D.C. now, and he's been talking about the importance of community-based groups, and he's organized such a group in Washington, and it's called Advocate Scene. I want to also thank everybody who called with their questions this afternoon, and thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's 3 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and this is Chico Freeman.